FM Talk 106.5 presents Alabama's first congressional district debate with incumbent Representative Bradley Byrne and challenger Robert Kennedy Jr.
All right, welcome. FM Talk 106.5 and AL1's congressional debate, as we have the two names you'll see on your general election ballot in studio. Not just the names, but the men behind those names have agreed to be here for this debate. It's going to last for the hour with a few news breaks in the mix. Your questions, I've been tallying those for quite a few days now, and big thank you to all of you in FM Talk 106.5 land that have contributed questions to be asked to Congressman Bradley Byrne and challenger Robert Kennedy Jr. this morning. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, Sean, good to be with you again.
Yeah, and thanks for, I want to say this as we get started here. Thank you for doing this, because number one, debates are a rarity these days. General election debates in the state of Alabama are an endangered species. So thank you, both of y'all, for doing this.
You're welcome.
Happy to do it.
All right. So I want to start off here. Let's just, this one ripped from the headlines. Just went through the national news as President Trump is calling for an end to birthright citizenship. This is, you know, just rolled out now. Would like to talk to both of you about this, this idea of birthright citizenship. Should it be the law of the land still in the state of Alabama? We'll start with Congressman Byrne.
Well, you know, when that first came about as a result of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, and I don't think the people that wrote the 14th Amendment to the Constitution intended for people to abuse it the way it's being abused now. So the fact that President Trump is trying to address it, I applaud him for doing it. I don't know that we can do it by an executive order. And it may not be something we can do by a statute. It may be that we're going to have to amend the 14th Amendment. But I applaud the president for taking the step that he's taken. Let's see where it gets. If it turns out that there's a legal problem with it, then maybe we need to take a step back and look at something else.
All right, Robert Kennedy.
Well, you know, I always find it fascinating that people say that they love the Constitution, but don't actually love how the Constitution is applied. I mean, birthright citizenship as a component of the 14th Amendment is one of the fundamental principles of our country, and it's something that should absolutely remain in place. Now, I've often talked about how I'm a different kind of candidate. And we know that there are individuals who are actually engaged in some tourism-type activities where the specific...
Birth tourism, right?
The specific reason why they're coming to do that is to have a child on U.S. soil. Let's focus on them specifically and figure out how to hold them accountable so that it doesn't happen, as opposed to talking about changing it across the board.
But if it's in the Constitution, you can't do that if you've got to change the Constitution. Or if it's by statute, you'd have to change the statute. So,
it's not by statute. It's in the Constitution. And so you're more in the center of the target when you talked about there may need to be a change to the constitutional amendment. And if someone wants to go through the amendment process, then we can have a conversation about that. It should not be
saying,
a conversation.
Right? I think it may have to be a constitution. I'm not a legal expert in this area, but we have people who are abusing it. And I think we need to do something about the abuse, and that's what the president's trying to do. It, whether he can do it by executive order or not, it is a legitimate question. But, you know, he's taken a step, and I think it's an important step.
All right. I want to move on here as let's talk about this on an immigration front. So the story for the last few weeks has been this caravan moving up through Central America, heading towards the U.S.-Mexico border, I think 900 miles away, the closest group right now. The president has sent another 5,000 plus troops to the border to help assist with ICE and border enforcement. So what happens? Let's talk about this. When that group, whether it's the entirety of the group or the first groups get there somewhere on the border, the response should be what? Congressman Byrne.
Well, I think the president's doing the right thing by sending the troops down there. I strongly support that. Now, they can only provide support to Customs and Border Patrol because they don't have the authority right to arrest or apprehend people. But that's a very important function. So I think what he's doing is very important. We're probably going to have to augment the Customs and Border Patrol units we've got down there. But we cannot let those people in this country. I mean, we cannot let that happen. So the president's taking the appropriate action, and I support him.
All right. Ms. Kennedy.
So I actually want to point a couple of things out. But first of all, I want to take a step back. Representative Byrne sent out an email this past weekend with the headline, Build a Wall. In the first two paragraphs, he described something that fuels the fear associated with this conversation. What we need to do is we absolutely need to have strong border security. That is a requirement. I am not in favor of open borders at all. But we actually need to look at what is happening and respond to it appropriately. So, if a person comes to your house and knocks on the door, there's a different reaction that you have as opposed to a person climbing through your window. So anybody who is in that caravan right now, who is coming to knock on the door and seeking asylum because they're fleeing violence, that person is not illegal. They have not performed an illegal act. If a person crosses the border, has not presented themselves, that person has committed an illegal act, and that is the person, if they're caught, need to be repatriated. We can have this conversation, and we can come up with viable solutions, but we can have the conversation with compassion, not necessarily through fueling fear.
Okay, I want to add this, though, and with a compassionate heart as well, you look at a point where you'll be overwhelmed with the number of people. And if you're saying you're fleeing, you know, you're finding asylum here from violence, well, my gosh, that can be a lot of places, right? The idea of asylum is specific to something about you in your country of origin, or something makes you a bigger target than somebody else. Violent communities, that's the globe. That's inside our country. So if that's the precedent for asylum, then how many people could show up there? And we've heard the stories how long it takes to process people on the border. With a compassionate heart, we could have delays of years and years and years for these people to get their day in front of a judge.
How bad would your life have to be for you to start walking thousands of miles? So some of the language that's coming out of the administration, which talks about the concept of MS-13 being embedded in, someone from a recruiting standpoint in the United States is trying to recruit MS-13 people from Central America and have them walk thousands of miles. You know that's not true. The representative knows that's not true as well. But that's the wedge, and we swing the hammer on the wedge because we need to fuel the fear that people are actually going to try to come to the country to do something bad. We can't We can't let everybody in. But the premise that the people are not fleeing violence is a premise that is flawed.
No, I'm not saying that. But if violence, and I want to let the congressman respond, but just for me, if violence is the reason for asylum seeking, that number of people that would be able to seek asylum in this country is incredibly large. I mean, I don't believe that fits the definition, Congressman.
Yeah, under our asylum statute, the mere fact that you've been subjected to violence is not enough to get asylum, okay? So it's not a matter of whether or not you have compassion for people. I do. I was in Honduras and Guatemala a month ago. I have a lot of compassion for those people, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to open our borders and let just anybody walk across. And by the way, I got to disagree with you. I do believe that there are gang people in this group of people coming up, and we've got some information to that extent. So the president does have a reason to say we've got to take extra precautions here. Look, I think we should build a wall. I've been very clear about that. I support the president on that. Not because I'm trying to be mean, but that's the means by which we've got to enforce the laws of the United States and not let people cross illegally.
Well, let's talk about border security for just a second. There are a portfolio of options that could be used in order to increase our border security. You could use drones. You could use humans. You could use night vision cameras. You could use fencing. And in some places, a physical structure like a wall may make sense. How do you know that the wall is the best option?
Well, I don't think the wall in and of itself is the only thing you need to do. You need to do all of those things. I'm saying the wall plus.
Okay, so then why is it that the own administration's reports coming out of either the government accounting office suggest that you don't have enough information right now from a due diligence perspective to know what those various options cost? Because one of the other options from a return on invested capital standpoint may allow you to improve border security at a price point that's cheaper. How do you know?
Well, actually, we do know what works and what doesn't work, and we know how much everything costs. How do we know that?
How do you know that the wall works?
Because we have places where we're actually using the wall today, and it has worked to keep people out. So we have a wall in around San Diego, as you probably know, and it's been very effective at keeping people out. And we know what it costs to build a structure like that, you know, by the number of feet that you're trying to do for each section. We know what the technology is we need to add to that, and drones are a great point that you make, and the night vision and the personnel. If you have a wall plus all those things, you have a very effective way of keeping people out of the country. And if we keep them out of the country, that solves a host of problems. You don't have to worry about separation of families and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Keep them out of the country. If they want to knock on the door, as you say, let them knock on the door.
Okay.
But don't let them come here illegally, because knocking on the door means you go to your embassy.
But if they come to the border and they present themselves to a border agent seeking an asylum, they have not committed a crime.
Well, if they cross over the United States to do so, they have. They've got to go to our embassy in Tegucigalpa, Guatemala City. and say, I'm applying for asylum. There is a process to work through that in our embassies. These people have chosen not to do that. They've chosen to break our law to come here. This particular group hadn't done it yet because they're on their way, but they stated their intention to break our laws. And so when you have a group of people from another country who said, I am going to break the laws of the United States, we have to take proactive measures to stop them from doing that.
But why do we have to have this conversation with language that's so reprehensible? Where is the accountability as an elected leader to hold people accountable for using poor language or suggesting things that cross the line?
Well, I'm going to stomp both you men here because we're running the news break, because if poor language is going to be what derails any debate, then Washington should have been derailed.
I'm talking to the congressman. This isn't about your commentary.
Yeah, this is no, it's not. I'm not taking it as mine.
I don't think it's reprehensible to talk about defending the borders of the United States.
Coming right back. More of the AL1 congressional debate. Got more questions. We're going to bring it right back home to AL1 too. Got a question from Milry coming up next. And of course, a series of questions from y'all right here, all Mobile County, Baldwin County, Washington County, all through AL1. Questions are coming in. And also, gentlemen, get ready. Speaking of congressional districts, what happens if we lose one in the state of Alabama?
Welcome back to FM Talk 106.5's AL1 District Debate with incumbent Representative Bradley Byrne and challenger Robert Kennedy Jr.
Welcome back. And we continue this discussion, and it's also live streaming on Facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5. Hello, Facebook. And you can watch it there, of course, and listen to it right here at FM Talk 106.5. And the podcast will be available as well after about 9 o'clock this morning. And something that the Facebook watchers heard y'all just talking about, and this is important. This is what I was talking about on Facebook a second ago, too, is that the fact you're sitting here doing this debate, this means a lot. Not the specific politics of either side, but the fact that we have a rational, we have big disagreements, but you have two candidates here that are respectful of the process, respectful of the debate, and respectful of the system that I think does more for the voter when we get to hear all ideas instead of just being shouted down. So a lot of respect to both of you for sitting down and doing this. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment on this. A lot of people were asking, how was it that I was able to get Representative Byrne to do something that a lot of other people weren't able to do? And I said, I just asked him. I didn't do it in the media. I didn't do it on social.
I just went
up to him and I asked him if there was an opportunity for us to get in the same place at the same time, because I thought from a leadership by example standpoint that those of us in Southwest Alabama could be the ones to lead this issue.
Well done.
And Sean, let me just say this. I wish the national news media would cover the times when what is happening right here happens in Washington. So these sorts of discussions happen in Congress all the time and in the manner that you're seeing it right now, but the national news media won't show it to you.
Right, because they want man bites dog.
Yeah, I mean, if I called Robert a name, that's a story.
Right.
If we sit here and have this really rational discussion with big differences of opinion, that's boring.
But, it may not be as sensational, I understand that, but it also, if we're going to lead from example and the greater discourse going on in our republic, then this is the example.
This is the example.
It is the example, but I want to pull that thread a little bit further. One of the things a representative has talked about, and I know he's told this story before, of him in a bipartisan way working with another member of the Alabama delegation that the cameras followed around, and when they didn't see anyone fighting, then they didn't cover the story. Along the same lines, when folks talk about what it means to be a Democrat, they're thinking of the definitions that come out of the national media.
Mm-hmm.
They're not thinking about those of us here in Southwest Alabama who grew up all with the same values. That doesn't get covered. And so one of the things I also think is important is that we're able to present ourselves as a different kind of Democrat than what folks assume coming out of other parts of the country.
And that's good. And it brings up so many other questions about mm-hmm. things going on inside the Democrat Party. But I want to stay specifically here and run through these questions here. I want to get Jeffrey and Milry asked, what can be done to help Washington County? The county is in serious trouble with no growth and losing one of our major tax sources. So what do you tell a rural county? I think I would have got two stoplights now. I love it. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Washington County. But I think two stoplights in Washington County, and people are looking probably to stay there and be employed.
Well, Washington County is like a lot of the rural parts of Alabama. It faces a lot of challenges in a modern economy. But I got to say, Washington County's done a better job than a lot of counties. They do have a number of large employers there, and they've done a good job not only retaining those, but helping to build employment base. That ultimately, for all of our rural counties, Washington County, Scambia County, Monroe County, Clark County, the ones in my district, ultimately, we have to do a number of things to help them. We got to work with them to help them keep their rural hospitals. That's critical. Secondly, a lot of them don't have broadband, and they've got to have that to be competitive. Third, and this is something they have to do, we can help them, but we've got to improve education out in the rural parts of Alabama, because the jobs we're creating in Alabama in the 21st century require higher levels of education and skills than we've normally thought of, and we have to have good, strong education out there so that the people in those areas have that education, and those skills, so that they can go get the jobs, and then therefore we can create the jobs in their area. So you have to do all of those things, and ultimately, as a congressman, I have to work as a supporter for local officials. I can't do it for them.
Right.
But I do a lot of that. I spend a lot of time in places like Washington County. I love going to Chatham. The people in Chatham have been so nice to me. And McIntosh and Millry and places like that. That's where real people live, and they have some real problems, and it's my job to support the local officials in trying to address them.
All right. Robert.
You mentioned McIntosh. My wife Aquilin and I were actually up in McIntosh this past Sunday. We had the opportunity to speak in church. And you want to talk about some really, really nice, wonderful people up there. While we were going to church, we actually got lost. The church is at a corner where you can't really see it from the road. So we ended up driving to the local police station, knocking on the door. And one of the officers came out. He didn't know where the church was, so he called dispatch. And then we got a police escort to church. So what a wonderful thing. This is one of the areas I don't have any disputes with what the congressman said on this. You need to have infrastructure. You need to have good education. The one thing that I will add that was not mentioned is we have to be very protective of the environment. One of the things that I heard as I was talking to people after church was that there was a chlorine leak at the Olin chemical plant, if I'm saying that correctly, earlier in the year. And there were a lot of concerns that they may not necessarily have gotten the visibility. And they are really, really concerned about the long-term implications about exposure. So if there is one area that I think we also need to make sure of is that we're protecting the environmental interests of the citizens in that part of the state.
Doesn't that kind of go back to what you were saying about broadband and other opportunities? Because so many of the jobs in Washington County are going to be at a chemical plant, or they're going to be in the timber industry. And listen, I got Ken and all this stuff. So,
yeah.
So it's not anti. But it's the reality is there are fewer and fewer of those jobs. And there's going to be more and more environmental regulations, as I think most people would agree. So there has to be other kinds of jobs, right?
Yeah. And we can create other kinds of jobs, like the new business that's moved from Canada Lock, Stock and Barrel to Monroeville that makes the cardboard packaging for craft beers, or the new high-tech IT business that we've got going in Bruton right now that has about 70 employees. Every one of those employees, by the way, are local. So they didn't import a bunch of real smart people from other places. They took real smart people that already live in Bruton and gave them the sort of education and training to do those jobs. So you got to think outside the box. But you have to start with the greatest asset you got in that area, in those areas, and that's the people. I had CBS News follow me around a year ago doing my town halls in those rural areas. And the last place we went to was Wagerville. And at the end of it, the CBS crew turned to me and said, "These are the nicest people. Even when they disagreed with you, they were so nice." And I said, "Yeah, that's kind of how we roll down here." So we start with the great people we have in those areas. But they do need, the environment is very important. And if we've got violations of EPA or ADEM rules, then we have to make sure that those are rigorously enforced.
Is there a way to but there's got to be a balance, because just saying right now that, no, we're going to crank down and these businesses can't exist, we need those jobs. So,
Sean, you're trying to create conflict on an issue that we don't have a conflict on.
Well, I'm not trying to create.
You got other stuff on your list.
I'm not
you can come
to
up
create conflict.
Else.
That's not what I do.
By the way, one of the great businesses in Washington County is the only site in the world where they make Splenda.
Yeah.
It's a Tate and Lyle facility. Mm-hmm. So wherever I go, all over the country, if I can find that yellow package, I pull it out and I show it to everybody around the table and I say, "Do you know where this is made? It's made in my district in Washington County," which just goes to show we can produce anything. We can produce high-tech airplanes, high-tech ships. We can produce Splenda. We can do anything. We can do it anywhere we want to in the state of Alabama once we make up our minds.
All right. I'll continue here with the questions. This kind of goes into what we had talked about earlier. A question from Scott says, is talking to the other side a way to lessen division and polarization? If it is, what have you done and what will you do to promote the two sides talking to each other?
I do it all the time. I'm the co-chair of the Congressional HBCU Caucus, the Historically Black College University Caucus. I'm the Republican co-chair along with the Democrat of the Singapore Caucus. I do that because ST Aerospace is here. I co-sponsor bills with Democrats. We have most of our legislation moves through the House in a bipartisan fashion. It actually happens for me every day that I'm in the House. I work with people on the other side of the aisle. Now, we have disagreements, okay?
Right.
But you can disagree, as we're doing today, mm-hmm. in an agreeable manner, in a rational manner, where you respect the other person. And I think that's the key. Respect the other person you're working with, whether you agree with them on a particular issue or not.
Right. We could we've got about 30 seconds here before the break. So if you want to start it, then we'll let you finish this idea after.
Yeah, I'll start with the fact that I'm a naval officer. I'm a 1992 graduate of the United States Naval Academy, and my responsibility is to take care of sailors. And when the alarms go off in the middle of the night and we have to respond to general quarters, nobody's asking if anybody's a Republican or Democrat. We're working together as a team in order to get the mission accomplished.
All right, coming right back. More of the AL1 Congressional Debate live here on FM Talk 106.5, streaming online and live video on Facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to FM Talk 106.5's AL1 District Debate with incumbent Representative Bradley Byrne and challenger Robert Kennedy Jr.
All right, we continue now with the AL1 Congressional Debate. And when we went to the break, we had talked to the question about working across the aisle. You know, the congressman and was talking, even if those of you watching on Facebook, what goes on more times than not in Washington. If you're elected, how do you work across the aisle, Robert Kennedy?
Well, I lead by example. Right. And what I wanted to pick up on as you ended the last segment is that I've been functioning during the campaign season the same way that I intend to function when I get to Washington. So the congressman knows that when he and I first met and the first time that I had the opportunity to ask him a question, I thanked him for the number of town hall meetings that he has. He has a large number of town hall meetings compared to other members of Congress. We also went to 13 of the 15 town hall meetings that he has had here over the last couple of months. And the reason why my wife and I went to all of those meetings was we wanted to hear what the congressman had to say, but more importantly, we wanted to hear what the crowd was asking him. And then whenever the sessions were over, we went up to the people in the crowd who asked the congressman questions, and then we continued the conversation. I believe that the only way that we're going to have more bipartisanship is if we actually proactively talk to each other. And that is the thing that my wife and I did by example, by going into an environment that folks would typically not expect us to be in. Mm-hmm. And one funny story, we actually went to the GOP rally that was in Monroeville. And we met a couple there, and my wife and I talked to them. A few weeks later, we had the Democratic rally. And we looked out in the crowd, and we saw that same Republican couple that was there. And so when we talked to them afterwards, he said that because we were willing to come into the GOP environment, he was willing to come into the Democratic environment because he wanted to hear what I had to say. And if that one step is something that we can replicate thousands and thousands of time, then that gives me hope for our country.
All right. I want to move to some of the more contentious things then, because I will ask very specifically, if you are elected, Robert Kennedy Jr., and you go and let's say here in the midterms, that the Democrats gain control of the House of Representatives, as so many believe. Do you back Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House?
It took you 37 minutes to get to that question. Why did it take you so long?
when would you want me to ask it?
You're just trying to stir that pot a little bit more. This actually serves as an example of the thing that I'm talking about, which is one of those lightning rod issues.
Well, I'm just asking the questions that people ask me.
I understand what it is. And really, that's kind of like next week's newspaper.
Yeah.
But I'll give you what my thought is on it. I'm a military person, like I said before. My roommate from undergrad is currently a commanding officer in Major Command. He's a graduate of Top Gun. He's an FA-18 pilot. And he's doing a fantastic job protecting our country. No matter how good he is as a commanding officer, the amount of time you're able to do that is time-bound. So In terms of voting for or against her, I first of all need to know who's running against her,
okay,
so that I can make an informed decision. But I don't have any issues with that command being passed on to somebody else, because we still have the advantages of her perspective that she would have, even if she is not actually the Speaker of the House.
All right. So, okay, go ahead. Evan, finish.
I have one more thing that I want to say about language, and this gets to the issue of accountability. We were in town hall meeting yesterday in Balabatri.
Mm-hmm.
There was a gentleman who was to your right in the front who made a reference to former Speaker Pelosi in a manner that was inappropriate. That is an example of the type of language that we need to be correcting on the spot. Now, I know you didn't say anything, but I just wanted to use that as an example of when we interact with constituents, we need to hold them to a standard of discussing things appropriately.
And I think
as well,
you heard me say that I'm not going to refer to her in the way that he referred to her, because I agree with you. I don't think it was appropriate. I will answer that question very clearly. I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker.
But I'm not going to let you get off that easily.
Yeah,
So Paul Ryan leaves. Yeah. Where do you go? Who would you back right now as Speaker of the House?
I promised two men.
Kevin McCarthy?
I promised two men that I would sit down with them after the elections and let them make their case to me. One is Kevin McCarthy, the other is Jim Jordan. They're both good friends of mine, and I want them to make their case to me. The reason I didn't commit to either one of them beforehand was I told both of them, I want you to take the energies that you would pour into convincing me to vote for you to go out there and get people to vote for our candidates so we retain our majority. And they've been pretty good about doing that. So, I mean, if I had to pick between either one of them, I'd be happy. But I want them to convince me that which one of them is the best person to lead us going forward. Now, it makes a difference. It does make a difference whether we're in the majority or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're in the majority, then I'm going to say, how are you going to lead us in the majority? If we're in the minority, I'm going to say, okay, we're in the minority now. How are you going to lead us in the minority? So I want to give them both the opportunity.
You're saying it'd be probably a different resume for being in the majority and
being
in the minority.
Yeah. You know, I was in the minority in the Alabama State Senate. I can tell you what it's like. It's not fun. And so you got to have somebody that understands the dynamic you're dealing with when you're in the minority is different than the dynamic you've got when you're in the majority, particularly when you're in the majority and your party controls the White House. You've got an extra level of responsibility because mm-hmm. you've got to make things work. Now, if you're in the minority and your party's in the White House and the majority is trying to use their majority status to ding your president, then you've got a different circumstance altogether. So I want to give both of those men, and I told them I want to give them fair opportunity, both of them, make the case. Tell me how you're the best leader.
All right. This is interesting, too, because it kind of brings up a subject of the bicameral system and things coming out of the House, because I've watched it with you, Congressman Byrne. Going to the Senate, where nothing happens, even though the Republicans in control of the Senate, you could argue it's a narrow margin, Sean, but things for a long time have gone from Republican bills in the House, go to the Senate, and then nothing. They get put. They're in a bottom desk drawer somewhere of like my old teacher desk, the big metal. We don't hear anything about it. How do both of you men get the ideas, whatever they would be, of AL1 to see the light of day if you come out of the House and get to the Senate? How do you do that?
80% of the bills that we send over to the Senate, we're passing on a bipartisan basis.
But I'm going to focus on the 20.
It drives me crazy to see these bipartisan bills languish in the Senate like to do. The problem is the Senate rules. I mean, they need to change their rules. And it's totally up to them what their rules are. Constitution doesn't prescribe it. So I've had this discussion with several senators. I won't name their names. And they've pushed back on me about that. I'll be honest with you. They said, no, you don't understand what you're talking about. But if you sort of step back and look at it, they need to become a more majoritarian institution where they get things done. And if they want to keep the filibuster, fine. But make somebody get on their feet and do the filibuster.
Do it. Robert Kennedy Jr.
Well, the Senate has rules, and if the Senate wanted to change its rules, it would have changed it. You saw that happen earlier in the year when they changed the rules with the number of people who had to approve confirmation for the Supreme Court. Representative Byrne here has the opportunity to lead. He's kind of telegraphing the fact that he's going to run against Doug Jones in 2020 by creating the type of content that would allow something to be approved during the budget reconciliation process as opposed to the normal order. If they want to change the rules, then what he needs to do is to convince them that they should change their own rules as opposed to making a proposal on his side.
Well, okay, I want to mention that because you're saying that, and we'll find out, I've asked this question of the congressman here as of late, whether he'd be running for Alabama's Senate seat, and you have run for Alabama Senate. So both of y'all, both of y'all, you know, are I think I can ask this question to you. Having run, will you run again for Senate if you do not win for the House of Representatives?
I will say unequivocally today that I will not run for the Senate in 2020.
Okay. All right.
I'll say unequivocally that I'm studying running for the Senate.
All right.
Representative, you can make this all easier and just resign right now.
And not going to do that, Robert.
You could have a couple of years to run for the Senate.
No, I'm not going to do that. I'm running, and I'm going to intend to serve the full 2 years of my next term.
I looking at the Senate just from as a citizen's perspective, you know, we used to and still do to a large degree punch above our weight class, right, in the Senate. Obviously, with Senator Shelby and head of appropriations and all that, and we had, you know, when Jeff Sessions was still the senator, we had such a senior delegation in the Senate and got a lot of things done. Obviously, one part of that is gone now, the seniority, and I mean, I don't have anything on fact or anything, but it seems like this may be it for Senator Shelby. And so could we, you know, what does that do to a state of like Alabama that needs to get some attention when we lose all that seniority so quickly?
Oh, it could be devastating. If you just walk around the state of Alabama and look at the military installations or the military interest we have at our shipyard here, if Washington or the Pentagon decided, hey, we're going to start pulling out of these places in Alabama, it would devastate the Alabama economy. So, yeah, I mean, having strong senators is important to that. And, you know, if we have the circumstance where we have a new senator in 2020 and a new senator in 2022, so you have 2 years of experience and seniority between them, oh boy. And if you add to that, that as a result of the census in 2020, we lose a House seat, that is like a 1-2 punch. So having the right people in those positions who can try to make up for that is critically important to us.
There's another thing that's actually, I believe, even more critically important, is having appropriate representation in both parties in the House. So when you talk about our representation right now, that it's primarily on the Republican side, we should have that balance with representation on the Democratic side as well. So as a former military officer myself and a person who spent multiple years in business, I understand the types of issues that are required in order to convince people to keep military assets in this part of the country. Mm-hmm. That does not get lost if you end up making a change.
Yeah, but if you think politics doesn't play a role in that, I'm just got to tell you, politics does play a role.
Politics plays a role in everything.
I want to ask this before we run to the break here, because this is you mentioned it, and this was one of my questions here. So we could go from 7 to 6 congressional districts in the state of Alabama. People, and I've talked about this for a year or so, and it seems like people are just waking up to this possibility. Number one, you know, what does that mean for AL1? Have you heard? What, you know, where would we grow AL1? How would it be taken in? And number two, the process, the argument's been made by the Attorney General's office and others that this process is flawed because of the data being used to decide the populations that are growing and the populations that are not. And in taking in people that are not legal residents of the United States as being part of the citizenship of the country, right? So you're going to get representation for the number of citizens. This gets into some semantic legal arguments, but I think it's one that bears out in real world situations like Alabama possibly losing a congressional district. So what do we do here? Do you believe that this is flawed methodology leading to this, and what can be done, or what can be done without the flawed methodology?
I think there is flawed methodology for counting non-citizens. We should only count citizens. And I do think Alabama could be hurt by that, because that would favor states like California. And so I strongly support the litigation that's out there right now, but I would like for us to fix it statutorily as well. So I know that the president wants to only count citizens,
right,
and there's litigation, you know, going against that. So we're going to let it shake out in the courts, but I wish Congress would act in the meantime.
Okay, because people need to go read the language there, too, and understand why there is some confusion, right, to what the founders meant.
I personally don't think there's confusion, by the way. I read the language,
yes,
but, you know, you can twist things around and get, you know, you go forum shopping and get a judge to say, yeah, I agree with that. Then we got to wind our way all the way up to the Supreme Court. I think I know where the Supreme Court's going to come down on that. I think they're going to say you can only count citizens, but I worry how long it's going to take for us to get there.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually think that we need to have as much population as a state as possible. We want our congressional delegation to be as large as possible. There's a subset of non-citizens that I think should be made citizens, and this should happen relatively quickly, and those are the DACA community. So these are the folks who are brought to the country through no fault of their own by their parents. And one of the wonderful things about our country is that we don't tend to hold children accountable for the actions of their parents. There's a sailor right now somewhere in the world that joined the United States Navy as a result of the DACA program. And that individual, when they leave with their honorable discharge, should actually have citizenship immediately. And when you're talking about the larger DACA class, we can have a rational conversation about whether or not their path to citizenship is short, medium, or long, but they should definitely have a path. And all of them should be included as citizens while we talk about everybody else.
All right, coming right back, and we're going to get some closing thoughts from both of y'all here for the AL1 congressional debate. Congressman Bradley Byrne and challenger Robert Kennedy Jr. in studio, and we will return in 2 minutes.
Welcome back to FM Talk 106.5's AL1 District Debate with incumbent Representative Bradley Byrne and challenger Robert Kennedy Jr.
All right, welcome back, FM Talk 106.5, and the only one of these going on in the state of Alabama. Maybe you two men have set an example for others here for congressional debates in the general around the state and maybe elsewhere. So thank you. Thanks for doing this. I want to give a couple minutes here for some closing thoughts from y'all and any more information you want to pass along. But I do want to ask this question: with the economy doing as well as it is, even though there are, you know, we can pick. I'm a fair guy. I can look at what's happening in the market right now. I can look at the interest rates, question what's next. I don't know what's next, but I know that regular folks in my peer group, this is not scientific, it's anecdotal, they're doing a lot better. They're doing a lot better. Yeah, they're doing a lot better. Their businesses
little
are
better?
Doing better. No, they're doing a lot better.
Okay.
And dollar flow and confidence in investing in their companies and going forward. They attribute a lot of this to the tax cuts and the change there, Republican tax cut plan. If you were elected, would you vote to repeal those tax cuts?
If I was elected, I would look very seriously at the corporate tax rate.
Okay.
Right? And the reason why I start with the corporate tax rate is there was a very rational argument that the corporate tax rate at 35% was too high. And that was leading to dollars being left overseas. Part of the theory behind doing the tax cut at the corporate level was that those dollars would be repatriated. What we saw during the repatriation process was a vast majority of those dollars actually went into company buybacks. And those company buybacks are stock that is tied to how the senior executives are compensated. So to a certain extent, they're putting the money in their own pocket. Now, the numbers are what the numbers are, and I'm not going to debate the metrics whatsoever pointing in a positive direction. But the thing that got lost in the conversation was the debt and the deficit. They got completely lost. And so all of the smoke and mirrors associated with the program led to a 1% increase in tax revenue, but a 7% increase in overall tax spending. And that all happened in the current administration. And so if we're ultimately going to address that problem, we're going to have to look at these tax rates again. And for the corporate tax rate is the first place, and then probably folks at the top end of the income bracket as well. That tax bracket going from 39% to 35% is something we may need to look at again.
All right. And Congressman knows when we're talking about debt, Lord knows I've talked his ear off on this. I said, you know, you could make one side of the equation go up, but when the other drops, you know, what's your take on that? Because it definitely has spurred the economy, but what about the long-term implications?
Oh, I think now that we've done tax reform, we've got this turnaround in the military, I think the biggest problem facing America is the debt. So that's why I had this bill that would take a big chunk of mandatory spending, not Social Security and not Medicare and not TRICARE, and make it discretionary. Because right now, I don't get to vote on mandatory spending.
Right.
That's two-thirds of our expenditures. So this would free up $1.2 trillion and give Congress the authority to cut it. And I think we need to cut that $1.2 trillion and hold back our expenditures and the present discretionary money. If you do that, excuse me, with the tax revenues increasing along with the economy, you can balance the budget. We did it in the 1990s. We could do it again.
All right. I hope you're correct there. Any closing words, Congressman Byrne?
I want to tell you what an honor it is to be in the same room with Robert Kennedy Jr. I really appreciate him as a person. By the way, I appreciate your service to our country and the United States Navy. You can see he's a gentleman, and he's a very smart, well-informed person as well. And so it's just an honor for me to be with him. It's an honor for me to be with you. And it's an honor for me to be with the people of this district. I mean, I've been in this job now for 5 years. And what a wonderful group of people I get to represent. And you're one of them. So whatever happens next Tuesday, you and I are going to be friends for the rest of our lives. And I'm glad we've had this opportunity together.
And closing thoughts.
I appreciate it. I actually want to make one policy reference before we're done. Standing behind you right there is my wife, Aquiline Kennedy. She had a stroke at 18 years old. Mm. She's a 3-time survivor, 2 heart attacks and a stroke. Those are all pre-existing conditions. She was actually sitting in the Oval Office when the precursor to the Affordable Care Act was actually signed. And when you think about the aspects of the Affordable Care Act, it needs to have some work. But one of the things that we cannot have is a situation where pre-existing conditions are not covered, because my family depends on that for her to stay alive. And so my ask of you is, you go back to Washington and continue to work through these issues, make sure that whatever policy ends up being enacted, it is one that continues to protect folks with pre-existing conditions, because we know from the business side, there is no private sector solution that can make that customer segment profitable. And so if you do anything, more than likely, the private industry will price individuals out of the market so that they cannot actually do that. So if you could keep that in mind, I would appreciate it.
You have my commitment on that.
Okay. And the other thing is...
We have just about 30 seconds here. So
right. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that I'm an American, and I love my country as much as you do. And the reason why I decided to enter office or enter the campaign for office was to protect the citizens in this area, including the citizens in 8 Mile, Alabama. And so when it comes to the issue going on in Pritchard right now with the fire truck, if there's anything that you can do to help us out, I would certainly appreciate it.
You have my commitment on that as well.
There we go. Robert Kennedy Jr., Congressman Bradley Byrne, thank you for your time. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll talk more about this coming up on Midday Mobile today at noon. Laura Ingraham Show is on the way next.